outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
Wayne, I survived my first GSW today.
Gunshot wound?
Yes.
Oh, really? See, I knew what a GSW was. I watch enough police TV. Is this self-inflicted, or did one of your kids take a shot?
No. So this was a scenario that we were doing at the college. I teach, one of the classes that I teach is crisis intervention, and they were doing a mass casualty scenario at the college. And seeing it was working with the hospital, the EMS, law enforcement, and fire department to find out whether or not a mass casualty situation would overload their capacity and their ability to be able to provide care. And so I was, my character was the faculty member that was teaching that went and opened the door, and the shooter came into the room, and I was the first gunshot victim. And so I had a GSW to the chest. I was unconscious, and they provided care. It was actually very impressive. They got 17 victims from the time that they started. They showed up on campus to the time that the drill was over was under 45 minutes. They transported 17 patients to the hospital and started providing acute care in under 45 minutes, which was pretty dang impressive.
So did you get transported?
I did. Yes, I got strapped to a bodyboard and
the whole thing. Wait till that ambulance board bill comes. That'll be quite the shock, won't it?
Yeah. I thankfully I have insurance for that, but I would be very shocked if I got billed for doing a drill with them. So,
but it's tragic that we have to practice that kind of stuff.
It is. Yeah. Wow. It was challenging, but especially from the perspective of teaching students, when I work with them, we look at what is EMS's response. So what is the emergency management response to it? But then to a situation like that, but then we also look at what is the acute care afterwards. So what is the psychological care that's required? What is the ongoing physical care that's required? How do you manage that? How do you create a plan for your client? And so it was very, very, very helpful to be able to be a part of that and watch all the different elements at play and their different roles and procedures and policies all functioning together.
So you're going to have to go to counseling for a while to get over the trauma of the shooting?
Thankfully, no. Now, okay. If I would have encountered something along those lines or had somebody that was a close friend or family member that had gone through something like that, then yes, I probably would not have volunteered to be a victim in that situation because it probably would have been a little too close to home still.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, the 2026 is off to a great start in Wyoming, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are more prepared at a different level now, I guess.
Yes, wow. And for you personally, is 2026 off to a good start?
It is. It's been a really good start to the year so far. Already, there's been some interesting new connections and relationships in the community that are starting to develop. In fact, I've got coffee with a gentleman that I met just recently, and we're going to actually connect and have lunch together tomorrow. So really excited for that. And yeah, just a lot of new things on the horizon. Jess is really excited about work. The girls are settling back into school, and we're just getting back into a rhythm here in Sheridan again.
That sounds good.
How about you?
Well, not much has happened yet. I'm finally getting the book off to the copy editor and down the road, so I got to make a lot of publishing decisions, the best way to take this book into the marketplace of ideas. So I've had that on my head and heart a lot. Other than that, yeah, things are off to a good start.
Do you have any kind of timeline on when the general population is going to be able to have access to said book?
I'm hoping mid-February. That's the plan. If all the little ducks fall in their rows, then we can make that happen.
Well, I'm Kyle Rice.
And I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And welcome to the God Journey.
Hey, we misled people last week. I jumped the gun, said it was our 23rd season. Turns out to actually be our 22nd. So we want to correct the record there in case people have done something because of that.
Set the record straight.
Yeah, get all their flags changed from 23 to 22. So they're flying outside their house. Yeah, whatever they're doing.
So what's the best thing you heard this week?
Well, I'm going to pull this from the New York Times.
And ooh, okay.
Part of their morning column, but I love this. It said, babies and toddlers are unselfconscious when they dance. They're spontaneous, present, unconcerned with who's watching them. Babies don't perform movement, they discover it. Do adults perform movement when they dance? Of course they do. We do. We have no choice. We've done it before. So each time we dance, we're reenacting the remnants of every time we've danced previously. We try and fail and try again to catch the rhythm. We think about how we're being perceived. But what a privilege it is to move, even if it's awkward, to be embodied and expressing and trying to be responsive to a beat, to be more subject and less object.
More subject and less object. I like that.
I like the whole thing of, you know, because I'm not a dancer. And when I have danced, I took lessons and tried to do it for my daughter's wedding. And Sarah doesn't like dancing, so we don't do a lot when we're in occasions to allow to dance. But I can tell you, when I am dancing, I am incredibly self-conscious. And I'm trying to mimic steps and try to do everything this talks about messing up. And the reason I really like this is because I think our walk with God kind of goes this way, too. You know, I think it's meant to be something we're embodied and living and expressive in the reality of the moment and not trying to follow a regiment of discipline or priorities or worried about what, how people are perceiving us or seeing us. If we could find that freedom again to be little children and just enjoy a walk with God and enjoy, sometimes you can get off beat, sometimes you're going to miss something. But if we were okay with that because we weren't self-conscious about how I'm being perceived, I think people would find this life in Jesus a lot more refreshing.
See, I loved the imagery as you started off reading that because I've got two little girls who dance without any reservation and they love to dance. Most of the videos that I have of them is them dancing in some wild fashion, wearing some crazy outfit that they have done. And it just, to me, watching them in their delight, it's humbling, honestly, because I enjoy dancing. I used to teach salsa in college and have taught country swing, and my wife and I really enjoy dancing together. But it's definitely requires a much higher level of brain focus for me. I'm very self-conscious as well. I'm watching my steps. I'm watching the moves. I'm making sure that I'm not stepping on my wife's feet or tripping us or causing any major problems. And so it's intriguing watching my daughters in their unrestricted joy and movement, especially when I think about relationship and especially in relationship with Christ and the way that I approach him. It's like, man, is it more structured? Is it more organized? Am I thinking about it more? Or am I just approaching him with the unabashed, unrestricted joy that my daughters move through life with? So I love that image.
I get those videos of our granddaughters too, doing that kind of dancing and free. And now I've got one who's a senior in high school, who's part of the dance team. It's every movement is choreographed and got to be on beat with everybody else. And that's all part of that whole thing. And honestly, I think she enjoys it less.
Really?
Yeah, I should go dance in college. Nope, I'm tired of it.
She's done.
It's not fun, particularly when the people on the dance team are not getting along well, as teenage girls are wont to do sometimes, a lot of rivalry and all that kind of stuff. And you just take the joy out of it. And I think that's how we do with our walk with God, too. We let religion, religious performance, worried about what other people are thinking, trying to get it right. We do all that stuff, and we lose the simple joy of being God's kids in the earth. So I really enjoyed that. What about you?
Mine actually comes from a podcast that I was listening to this week, and I'm grabbing the title here for you just so that I have it. It's Adam Grant's podcast, and he was interviewing an African-American individual who has been working with the Ku Klux Klan for the last 25 years. And the title of the podcast was Loving People Out of Hate. And it was just an incredibly powerful podcast overall, because it was really unpacking what does it look like to work alongside of people. And the person that was doing the podcast had a very unique perspective, which I'll get into a little bit more. But the line that really stood out to me was, always leave the door open for love, because it can change the world. Be there to support, to encourage, to champion them. That does not mean that you have to agree with them, but that is the way that you can leave the door open for the world to be changed by love.
Hmm. Wow.
And that I loved that perspective, because when I was thinking about it, I get into a lot of conversations with people when they're talking about, okay, what do I do with X family member or this friend that I care about, but they're making these life choices that I don't get in alignment with, that I can't be involved with. And this podcast was talking about the perspective of someone who is working with people who have an ideology around hate. Hating his race. And this individual
hating his own race?
No. So the African American being hated by these neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan, this ideology. And it was interesting because the person being interviewed by Adam, he was a ambassador's son. And so the concept of racism wasn't a thing for him because he spent so much time overseas that it wasn't until he was 10 years old, so middle elementary, came back to the United States and started encountering significantly negative behavior just because of his skin tone. And he couldn't conceptualize that. His parents sat down and had a conversation with him for the first time at 10, that there's such a thing called racism and that people can despise you or people often can hate you. And the only justification for that hate is the color of your skin and the assumptions that they have about you because of that. And he thought they were lying to him. He genuinely thought that that could not be possible, that he must have done something, that there was something in his behavior, because he ended up getting attacked by some young adults and came home. And that was what catalyzed the conversation, was he got attacked by a group of Caucasian young adults, and his parents had to sit him down and have the conversation with him for the first time at 10, that there's this thing called racism. And he just could not conceptualize that that was even a thing. And so then a year later, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And then he was like, oh, okay, maybe there is actually this thing about racism. And that was the initial foundation and catalyst for the work that he's doing now, where he actually works with a former general of the Ku Klux Klan that ended up walking away from the ideology because he saw the love that this individual was willing to express. And so just a super cool podcast.
Wow. That sounds very interesting. Reminds me of a quote I'm reading. Sarah and I have just finishing a book that I'd love to talk some on the podcast about. Okay. Except I know it's one of those third rail issues that freak people out. One of the quotes that came out of that book, he's quoting James Baldwin, but it says, I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense once it is gone, they will be forced to deal with their pain.
Oh my gosh, that is so true.
Isn't that good?
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, that there's an underlying pain that evokes hatred, evokes the way we respond to people. And if you can't express that negatively toward people around you, then you have to be able to say, okay, then there's something in here I've got to deal with that I can't just export to people.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the theme of this whole book. The book's called My Grandmother's Hands, interestingly.
Okay.
And it's the subtitle is Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies. It's by Resma Manickam. And this was actually recommended to me by a good friend, Stephen Vosla, out of South Africa, who said he'd been reading this book, thought it was incredibly powerful and wonderful. And Sarah and I started through it. And it's not an easy book to read, I'll be honest with you. Because he does a lot of stopping and telling you how to read. And then there's a lot of body activity that you do to try to get rid of racialized trauma. And he talks about us all having it. There's white body trauma, there's black body trauma, and then he deals with police body trauma. He deals with those three different groups of people. And how trauma, one of the things he said very early on in the book, which I thought was intriguing, there's no evidence of racism because of skin color prior to the 1700s.
Really?
That's shocking. But when you think of the Queen of Sheba visiting Solomon, you think about the interplay between cultures. There's nothing in the literature back in the day that someone's skin color gave away either their physical or mental acuity or their lack of, or people judged by that. Nothing until slavery became a thing in the world. And then people were resorted to racial kind of language to diminish to dehumanize the people they wanted to enslave. And so, I'm just going, oh, really? So this is a modern phenomenon.
See, and that's intriguing because I'm wondering about that because you think about, okay, the Hebrews are enslaved by the Egyptians, right? And so you have that whole situation that occurred and they were slaves, but it was based on tribalism and nationality, not necessarily the color of their skin. It was based on their tribe. And so I'm wondering if...
I think that's what he would say. The slavery of the past and the looking down on cultures, that all had to do with tribal and tribal power. It wasn't correct due to skin color.
No, that would make sense. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a fairly new thing. And he says this, and this is a provocative statement. If you have a white body, you automatically benefit from white body supremacy, whether you want to or not. Even if you're the most fair-minded person on earth, at times certain privileges will be conferred upon you because of the color of your skin. If you have white skin, you have a responsibility to share your privilege with others. Agree or disagree with that? What do you think?
I would say, especially in modern culture, that I would agree with that because I think that I have experienced privileges due to just the fact that I am a white male, that there's been benefits and things that I have experienced that have been privileges that I have benefited from, whether I was aware of them or not. My eyes really started to get opened up to that more in my international travel. So when I was not the majority, when I was the minority, now in some spaces, because I was from America, there was assumptions about me that gave me privilege. And in other places, it was not a privilege or a benefit to be a Caucasian male. That was not a good thing to be, especially from America. Yeah. So there was some challenges there. Looking back over human history, I think there's always been people, or whether it be a tribe or a gender or an ethnic background, that has had more control or more power over the resources, over the control, over the environment, over the society. And I think that a good leader, the people who hold that power, who hold that control, that it's their responsibility is to care for all who are under their service, who are a part of the world that they supposedly have control over, that control should be used to serve and care for the people that are around you versus having the space where I'm going to use this to my advantage and be able to push other people down so that I can get ahead. I mean, that's the difference between the wholehearted mindset or the love-based identity versus the fear-based identity, right? Because if my worldview is that we're not moving out of scarcity, but we're moving in out of a connectedness, then my connectedness is to everyone in my community, everybody that I'm a part of or engaging with, not just the people that look like me or think like me or act like me.
Right. Just by virtue of their humanity and their proximity to me. And I think what he points out, and others have as well, is this sense of whiteness, particularly, I think, in 21st century America.
Yeah,
you do. And not that we're not becoming more multiracial. We are as a country, but there's still a privilege that a white body has inside the culture that's often undetected by the white body itself. People often realize it. Yeah. I brought this up a few years ago, talked about white fragility from D'Angelo's book, and it really ticked off a lot of people in the podcast world. And it only got worse after Black Lives Matter and went down that whole road. It didn't help us as a country find a better way to communicate this.
Yeah.
It actually led to worse because there was a really action against Black Lives Matter with All Lives Matter, which is kind of slap in the face to what Black Lives Matter is trying to say. Of course, all lives matter. It's just that some lives matter less. And talking about that with some of my conservative friends is incredibly awkward and becoming increasingly so.
Hmm.
I've got a friend who's, I think, teaching in Florida the first year. One of the information they were given as teaching in a public school is the words you're not allowed to use in the classroom are diversity, equity, and inclusion. You're not allowed to use those words. And you've seen that with the current administration. We've suddenly made certain words that are meant to be give us language to help find a way to do what we're talking about. How do we find a way to spread privilege out, to let others have a participation in things that they've been denied? How do we do that? These are the words that we would use to do that. But I know, I hear you. I hear other people already saying, yeah, but those words were used to say, everybody's a racist. Everybody needs to go to training. All white people are bad. They're all oppressors. And yes, did it go too far with the spokespeople from the woke left? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. But we dare not retreat to the other side. We say, okay, now we can't talk about it. And I think people who, of color that I know are much more discouraged about the state of America today in terms of just being able to have a conversation about how this kind of racial divide affects people. And those that are just willing to say, no, let's just let off, everything's equal. We just judge a person by their character, not by their skin. And yet people with certain color skin are not listened to the same way, are not respond. Not always, not, but mostly. There are places where I know when I've gone to help somebody get through something in the bureaucracy of this town, if they're a person of color and I'm not, I get a better hearing than they do. That's why I go with them. So the person will take them seriously in the need that they're trying to express. But it's not fair that they need me to be there for them.
Correct. If you're there and you're advocating for them, it should be that you're there and advocating them for because you're their friend, that you have seen this individual's character and benefit to the community. It should be because you're there to honor their humanity, not because you're ethnic position gives you a greater voice in that situation.
Just that I'm taken differently.
Yeah.
And then they are. When I come with them and talk, and then I'm really not there to advocate for them. I'm really there to help them find a place at the table where they can advocate for themselves and be taken seriously by the people who are watching it and not stereotyping them in a way that's going to make them blow them off when they get to the end of their request or spiel or whatever. And I think it's real important that we have this dialogue. And yet, where are we having it today? Because the left went too far left. The left went to, they laced some kind of Marxism into this whole thing. And even the Black Lives Matter advocates, many of them just became wealthy on state funds and bought huge estates. And I mean, it was bedlam of human corruption. It just was in so many ways. Yes. But that has pushed the other side back from even being able to use a word like diversity, equity. How do we find equity? And I know equity got defined by the woke group as equal outcomes. And equity isn't equal outcomes. Equity is equal opportunity. The color of my skin shouldn't restrict the opportunities that we would have to move inside the culture and to advance and to do whatever. But the fact is, there is some caution, some brake pads on those things. And yet we can't talk about it now because certain words have been outlawed.
Well, and I think they've been outlawed, again, as you said, because when we try to react or when we try to change policy with a equal or greater amount of force than what was exhibited that caused the pain initially, then we just get this reactivity where we're ping-ponging back and forth from one end of the spectrum to the other, and people aren't moving towards the table for conversation. They're moving away from it because it's all about attack. It's all about, okay, how do I self-protect in this? And so now there's no space for conversation because now we're in fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. Our front brain is offline. Our relational part of our brain is no longer active. And now we're just looking at how do I self-protect or how do I self-promote? And I think that was the challenge was we had, you know, looking at even just the last few different administrations and the where this conversation is amped up, is we had one administration, you know, that was saying and pushing in one direction. Then we had another administration that swung to the other end of the spectrum. And so then there was, so then the tension increased, which caused people to step away from the table versus, no, we're trying to create a safe space where people can have a genuine conversation about what their experiences are like and be able to learn from that. And that's, that was one of the things that, so in this podcast that I was listening to, the gentleman that was the former higher up in the Ku Klux Klan that is now doing this reconciliation work, his comment was, I listened to my friend's story. I listened to this guy's story, and the ideology that I had given my life over, and this is the Ku Klux Klan individual saying this, the ideology that I'd given my life over to was hurting children. And I couldn't conceptualize in my mind that the ideology that I had, that I thought was helping to serve the nation that I cared about, was actually causing significant physical and emotional harm to innocent children. It's like, I couldn't conceptualize that. That in my mind caused a cognitive dissonance, which then allowed love to come in.
And the question is, why is it more significant if it's innocent children than other adults?
Yeah.
I mean, I get his process, and I'm grateful that whatever it was opened that door.
Yeah.
But oftentimes it does. We get down to, oh, the innocent children. We've got to do something there. And the point of his book, My Grandmother's Hands, and reading it wasn't, okay, this is how we need to influence national policy. In fact, he's very down on, in this climate, trying to affect national policy.
Yeah.
But he really talks about how we relate to people in our own sphere. And he uses this trauma motif, saying if you've had white privilege and you've taken advantage of white supremacy, even if you've not used that term, and even if you're not comfortable with it, that you have a trauma. There's a trauma both to the superior feeling group and the inferior feeling group in the way they're treated. And he talks about we can't heal together. We've got the white community has to heal together to realize how this trauma has affected the way they treat people of color. And people of color have to heal in their own community to find their own sense of identity and humanness again. And then we can have the discussion. He's not even trying to say, hey, let's get together and figure this out. And he's saying police are a different thing because they're given weapons and power in the state. And there matters less whether you're black or white, but the fact that you have power over people. And who are you most suspicious of when it happens? And so what he deals with, what I think is really good, is all looking inside here to say, how has this affected me and my relationships? And then he contrasts two things, which I'm hearing now more often. I've never heard this before in this book, but he contrasts clean pain, dealing with healing, and dirty pain. And I've not heard this before, but I'm now reading it in other places.
Yeah.
And he says clean pain is the kind of, first of all, he says all healing requires pain. And I love that.
Yes.
And he said, even if you refuse to deal with it, it will cause you pain. So there's pain here. Might as well move toward healing. Might as well.
Yes.
And so he talks about clean pain is what happens when your body is settled, when you kind of know what the right thing to do is, even if you're going to pay for it among your own tribe. You do it anyway. That's clean pain, moving toward healing.
Yeah.
Dirty pain is reacting out of whatever happened to me, either accusations against me or my skin color or whatever. And it's reactive and it's angry. And instead of it being healing, it actually creates more injury in the person who holds dirty pain and in the people who are around them. And I find that language very interesting. I have used it in my own life since. I think about situations I'm in and places where I might be hurt or going through something difficult. How do I deal with this pain in a way that's clean? It leads me to healing and it doesn't wound the people around me because I'm unsettled or I'm going through a difficult thing or I have questions that I can't resolve. And it is really, I measured my activity now. What I consider this clean pain. So it moves toward healing and doesn't damage people around me, or am I reacting out of dirty pain, which is if I'm frustrated or if I'm angry, I don't do much anger these days. I wish I'd had this when I was 40 years ago, when I was much angry. But am I doing something that, yes, is dealing with the pain here, but in a way that doesn't injure other people around me?
Yeah. Yeah. When I think about dirty pain versus clean pain, I think of clean pain is the good hard work required to be able to move towards wholeheartedness. Because it's not easy to look into those wounds, work through those injuries, to have those corrective experiences. All those things are very challenging. They're stretching, but in a healthy way. They're moving you towards a greater level of health and wholeheartedness in the world. They're also moving towards you being a safer person for the people around you to be able to process, to be vulnerable, to struggle, to be in the world. And so to look at that type of pain versus dirty pain, when I think about the dirty pain, I think of that's when I am operating, I'm reacting, I'm behaving out of the wounds, the trauma, the injury, the challenges that are in my life. And instead of working to try to heal those, I'm reacting out of those. And that's leaking that same toxicity that's going on inside of me as a result of that pain, of those injuries, that trauma. Now I'm shotgunning it to my community and the people around me and then causing more of a negative influence than a positive one.
And he says that's what's going on now, mostly with racialized trauma. We're racialized trauma. We are exporting our pain. We're living out of our wounds, either accusations or feeling like my kids are not going to have the same breaks in the world because we're trying to, you know, make room for other people, or all the things that cause us to respond. It's reacting out of our wounds. Instead of taking our wounds to a place of healing and wholeness and having the kind of interactions with myself and with others that lead toward healing. One of the things that he practices throughout the book is being settled, having a settledness in your heart. That when we're unsettled, when we're agitated, anxious, frustrated, angry, that almost always leads to dirty pain and putting more of it in the world. And at the place of our woundedness and brokenness and sorrow and grief and feeling abused, whatever, if we can settle, our system, he's talking about really physically settling that part of our nervous system, that when it's relaxed, when it's not necessarily resolved, but relaxed enough to process what's true, to be able to handle what you said, the hard work of finding my way to wholeness. And I think this, it's an amazing thing to even think that simply about what you're going through in terms of, is this clean pain I'm experiencing here, or is this dirty pain? And how do we find then a place of settledness in our own heart before we engage the conversations that we need to have?
I think one of the things that honestly sticks out to me in the midst of this conversation is, did you see the announcement by Pete Hegseth about the new standards that are going to be applied to the military across the board? It was very intriguing because there was a lot of reaction, a lot of negative reaction to what he was saying and to the standards that he was putting out there and whatnot. And yet it was very intriguing to me because I said, okay, but what he is saying is, what I hear him saying is, our military, in order to be at a level of fitness and ability to be able to fight and to be able to perform the duties and tasks that we have been ordered to do, to be able to fulfill effectively, we need to have a certain physical and training standard across the board. We can't raise and lower that, but we need to have a consistent baseline standard across the board, and we've moved away from that. And so now I'm going to implement a requirement that you have to hold to that. Well, then all of a sudden there was just this epic blow up about, well, men versus women, and who is that standard favoring? Is it favoring men or is it favoring women? Or LGBTQ in the military, is it favoring them? Obesity or overweightness, is it favoring people who are naturally more physically fit? I mean, there's all of this kickback that came as a result of that. And yet it was like, okay, hold on a second. Aren't these the people who are supposed to be defending our nation? And isn't there some requirements in order to be able to do that effectively? Like, shouldn't you be able to do more than 5 push-ups? And shouldn't you be able to run more than a mile without passing out? Like, I feel like those are some fairly standard things that our military should be able to do if these are the people who have been charged with protecting our nation. But immediately it became about gender. It became about gender identification. It became about physical aptitude. It became about biological sex versus we need to get back to a baseline standard that is held. So if you want to be in this role in the military, period, I don't care what your skin tone is. I don't care what your sexual orientation is. I don't care what your biological gender is. You must meet X standard. And it was very intriguing to watch the explosion that resulted from that.
So you're supportive of what he would say the military needs to be?
I would say that if we have a organization that is getting paid to protect our nation, specifically in significant threat environments, that there should be a standard level of physical fitness and training preparedness that should be a baseline acceptance, because they have that all across the board.
And you think, right? You would fight better without your beard?
Not necessarily, but honestly, like, if that's in alignment with the professionalism. So if I worked, whether it was for the military or whether it was in a different environment, there are standards that are required in order to be able to perform those tasks. And so, like, for example, with me, I have to have a master's degree in my area of study in order to be credentialed to provide education at a college in regards to my subject area. And yeah, so that's a baseline standard.
That's what I think was the concern, though, because he made the baseline standard for the entire military, not just frontline combat people, mm-hmm. but people sitting back in administrative posts or doctoring or whatever. I mean, there's lots of other things in the military that doesn't require True. You to have full. And I think, just to be honest, I think our defense secretary is a lightning rod and intends to be one. And he just ticks people off for the fun of it. And I think that's unfortunate. Okay. So I'm not going to say, okay, I think everybody needs to meet the same standard. I do think when a job is identified, like you said, teaching, you got to have X credential, you got to do, that's fine. Yeah. But when you make a blanket thing that seems to reward one kind of person over another, then it does fly in the face of, are we seeking for fairness to all?
Yeah.
Or are we limiting that fairness to our people, however we want to define that?
And I think that's fair. I think that, like, especially, like, for example, with the military, if you want to be a frontline individual, then there should be a set standard across the board. If you want to be in special forces, there should be a set standard across the board.
And doesn't there matter. There is correct. In special forces.
Yes, special forces did not let just anybody in.
That's a lot correct. Of people wash out. That's the truth. But I'll go back to this settled thing, because I think he says, few skills are more essential than the ability to settle your body. If you can settle your body, more likely to be calm, alert, and fully present no matter what is going on around you. A settled body enables you to harmonize and connect with other bodies around you while encouraging those bodies to settle as well. Gather together a large group of unsettled bodies or assemble a group of bodies and then unsettle them and you get a mob or a riot. But bring a large group of settled bodies together and you have a potential movement and a potential force for tremendous good in the world. A calm, settled body is the foundation for health, for healing, for helping others, and for changing the world. When I read this, I look at this. This is the peace of Christ that rules. Yes. This is what Jesus invited us into. Let me unravel the wounds, the broken places, and however that needs to happen in your life. But settled bodies being together, even with people that see the world differently, will lead to some wonderful things. And unsettled bodies, or getting a group of people together and unsettling them, can you say political rhetoric here? Isn't that the purpose of most political gatherings, is to unsettle this group of people, make them angry, and then send them out in the world, and the other side's doing exactly the same thing? And that's why, as our culture, we are collapsing because we're not finding settled bodies in the world or environments in which bodies who aren't settled can be settled. That doesn't mean you're perfect, doesn't mean you're healed. It just means my fear, flight, flight system is not being activated. And when it's not being activated, then I can be in my cognitive relational reality and have that kind of connection. And this is where even the book that we've been working on, Just Love, it really gets to those kind of people in the world is the way Jesus wanted his kingdom to be in the world. He wanted his kingdom, his people, to care about justice, to care about how people are treated around you, and to love them the way he loved them, which he would absorb their injustice, which he did on the cross, before he would throw it back in their face. He would absorb it, and he would bring redemption. And to me, I think that's the essence of what it is to be a participant in the kingdom, to be settled in your own body, and to then be able to be present, be kind, be able to listen to another person and help them. And to me, that's a lot of what Jesus came to do. And yet his followers oftentimes are not the most settled people on the planet, unfortunately.
No, because I think, sadly, a lot, even some of the Sunday morning gatherings that I've been a part of recently, it wasn't about teaching people to live a more settled and at rest, at peace, because they're dwelling in the presence of God lifestyle. They were actually riling people up. They were activating people. They were making them unsettled through different forms of angst and then saying, okay, go out and be out in the world. Which, again, it's like, okay, so you are, instead of modeling and encouraging people to go out and live in the world in a presence of love, you are riling them up about fear of their salvation or about fear of their behavior and
or
how
fear
that
of what the world's doing to them.
Yes, absolutely. Fear of what the world's doing to them or is going to do them in regards to their rights. And so from there, now go and be in the world. And the presence that they bring to the world is not a settled presence of love. Right. It's this anxiety provoked fear presence that's all riled up. And so there isn't any difference between their presence in the world and the presence of the world of the person next door who's doom scrolling on Instagram and getting riled up by all the fear-based content that the media is putting out.
Yeah. And this is not from the book I'd just been referring to, My Grandmother's Hands. This is from a different book I've read. This but plays right in here.
Yeah.
And that is to say, the best way to get someone to act unjustly in the world is to make them see that the other people treated them unjustly first.
Ugh.
If you can paint people as the victim of injustice, you can get them in the name of that self-protective, and you can even do it with, this is the way we honor God and bring the kingdom in the world. We'll go out and get those who've been getting us. And it's sad because what Jesus wants most is people who know him, who can live in his love, who can be a voice in the world for the kind of justice that treats all people fairly, kindly, lovingly, openly. And boy, do we need that today.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.